Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off the show with a sense of sadness. We'll reflect on the life of the late business mogul Dow Steyn. We're going to be reflecting on that in a moment. Our thoughts and our condolences go out to the Steyn family and to the Steyn community as well. Sad news that we found out earlier today, but that we will get to in a moment. What we do have coming up on the show today is we're going to be taking a look at multi-choice and the Canal Plus deal that is set to go ahead. We're going to be looking at the proposed post-takeover structure that has been put forward. We still are subject to regulatory approvals on that side. We're also going to be taking a look at what to expect from the State of the Nation address to be delivered on Thursday. Please remember, as a result of that State of the Nation, we will not be having an SAFM market update on Thursday. And then we're going to take a look at how to deal with home ownership when looking at being married in community of property. Some of the things you need to know, some of the things you need to think about where it relates to all of that.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
No, I haven't forgotten. We are still doing our weird and wonderful, strange laws from around the world. Today's law comes from the United Kingdom. And in the UK, it is a crime, or it may be considered a crime, if you were to die in the Houses of Parliament. The reason for that is that the building is considered to be a royal palace, which would then mean that dying in such a place would potentially entitle you to a state funeral. I wonder what happens there. I wonder if they just drag you out while you are still alive and deal with that later. Either way, we get straight into the show. We go into our market watcher segment. We're going to be taking a look at what the markets have been doing today. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at the market movements. Good evening, Nick. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Looks like a good day for our local markets, shrugging off that negative sentiment that came through from the US and what's been happening around the world. Rather strong day, particularly if we're looking at commodity counters or commodity companies because of the commodity prices. What do you make of today's movements?
Oh, good evening. Good evening to your listeners. Look, we're going to take some green on the screen, given what has transpired the last 48 hours. In fact, my head is still spinning trying to keep track of what's going on. I think the journalists refer to, what do they call it? It's a developing story. You know, each day can change. But right now, nice bounce back. We saw, Mr. Trump getting his deal done with Mexico, as he calls it, and Canada. So that gave it a little bit of risk on. And we saw a nice flow back. Some of the markets were open in the Far East. Of course, that Chinese New Year, they come back full tomorrow. So a little bit of positive impetus coming through. And I think the best barometer for that is Iran, which was on the other side of 19 in the early hours of Monday morning. It's now 1864. So in general, it's a positive day.
Mm-hmm. Nick, when we look at some of those movements, I mean, I'm looking at things like the commodity prices, the gold price kind of coming through at, or for the last couple of days, at least since breaking above 2,700 and even 2,800, coming through as a very clear indicator that when markets are concerned, they're now even potentially being concerned about the US dollar. And we're seeing that that safe haven play seems to be back on the cards. It wasn't always there for the last couple of weeks and possibly even the last couple of years, with the dollar returns kind of outweighing that. But suddenly markets are saying, hang on, the US situation might be a little more volatile than we thought. And the gold price absolutely loving that.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. You know, I'd say the dollar story, the gold story is certainly, I would say, years. I mean, I'd even go back as you know, the days of the sort of crisis in Europe with Greece, etc. You know, you never really had that safe haven status. You know, gold didn't display the qualities you all know it to be. And it's taken a long, long time. But just all of a sudden, the last couple of days, gold coming to the fore. And as you said, that is with a dollar index, which is knocking at 109, which is sort of multi-decade highs against some of the crosses. So despite that stronger dollar, gold is still coming to the fore, and I agree with you. But if you look at what happened on Monday with some of the cryptocurrencies, which are deemed to be the new gold or the digital gold, Ethereum was down 37% on Monday morning. So that was not your safe haven play. And yeah, that old-fashioned, boring relic, as they call it, is certainly coming to the fore.
Nick, how do we feel about the cryptos? How do we feel about I mean, there's obviously changing sentiment from an investor point of view, looking at new assets and all those things. But it does, as you say, seem like the old trusted ways are being reverted back to. And that could be human nature. That could be what gold is based on and its use cases. How do we feel at the moment about things like the alternative spaces in the crypto spaces?
I mean, just to wrap up the gold story. I mean, gold is, as I say, I'm not a gold bug by any means, but you've certainly picked up a lot of sort of facts that the central banks around the world have been stockpiling it. In fact, just early last week, the number of people actually withdrawing gold from what in the American market, which is COMEX, gold's traded majority in three countries, three entities, Zurich, London, and New York. And they were drawing so much money taking delivery of these future contracts in New York. They had to literally tap into the gold market in London to get delivery of these gold. So huge demand for gold. So it's not just speculation. It literally is taking delivery of that. So that's the gold story. But if you look at the crypto story, I think personally, I think it's a bit more of a liquidity story. So first and foremost, I think some of the crypto fans a little bit upset that Mr. Trump hasn't mentioned it a little bit more. Certainly has not been mentioning it. I don't think he mentioned it once the last sort of week. So that's been a little bit disappointing. And then secondly, I think it's, as I said, I think it's more of a case of liquidity. As people get a little bit nervous, as liquidity is drying up, as people are flying back into safe havens, certainly that crypto space is not getting the flows that we thought. And there's been some big liquidations if you read the crypto news. So yeah, I think the jury's still out on that new gold story, which they like to play.
Nick, when we look at some of the local developments, I mean, our local market's having a really stellar day with industrials leading the charge there and financials not too far behind. Financials didn't have the best day yesterday when we initially got those sentiments from Washington, but seemingly shrugging that off very, very quickly. And part of that could have to do with the response that the South African government has given, but also part of it could have to do with the fact that markets are looking in South Africa and saying that shouldn't really affect the financial positioning of the country.
Look, as again, this is when I go back to that little asterisk. This is a developing story. It's look, I think a little unfairly hit, but then, I mean, don't feel so bad, all of us looking at the rand. I mean, I could show you graphs of the Brazilian real, and of course closer to what has been affected, the Mexican peso and all the other EM currencies, they all took a big knock as well. Obviously, the rand, the South African market getting spoken about, and Mr. Ramaphosa being in the headlines as well. Also, a little bit of news flow coming out of the mining in Durban. I know it's been lost a little bit in the news, but that's been on. That's going to be on all week, so a little news flow out of that. So I think the rand has been a little bit on the back foot, and those financials were not in line with a weaker rand. But I think also a little bit unfairly so, because it's recovering a little bit now. And if you believe the positive growth stories that the South African sort of administration is talking about, trying to get us closer to sort of 2-2.5% growth, that should lead into a more positive sort of financial sector. So the bank's coming back a little bit today.
Nick, how do we get to the 2 to 2.5% growth? What kind of sectors are you looking at seeing a lot of movement from? I mean, obviously the commodity pricing very much benefiting the PGM miners, the gold pricing benefiting the gold miners, and we're starting to get updates from companies as well around their performance. What are you looking for at this point?
I think first and foremost, some of those are out of our control. So what we want to see is a weaker dollar, and maybe we're just getting it on the start of it now. So the weaker dollar will obviously feed through into the commodity basket, which is positive for commodities. And then I'm also telling you that the tariff story has got to be positive for commodities. I mean, you saw Mr. Trump today talking about any more aid that's going to Ukraine, we're going to be wanting some rare earth metals in return, and that's coming back to fore the whole. If you look at the green energy story as well, if you look at Mr. Trump talking about sort of reversing that and getting back into fossil fuels, etc. That's certainly positive for the mining sector. So I think there's a little bit of tailwind for that commodity sector. How it feeds through to South Africa is obviously very important, but also you can't have a, out the blue, you can't have a load shedding on a Saturday morning. That certainly is not what foreign investors want to see. So we've got a little bit of more work to do. But I do think I'm going out on a limb here. I do think that there are certain things going into place. And I look forward to Thursday with the Sono, actually. But I do think there's some positive tailwinds coming through for the first time in a while.
Nick, is anything concerning you from the developments that we're seeing? I mean, the ongoing story that is the developments that continue to unfold. We see that every time we get some news or every time we get some important information, it does have an impact on how markets are reacting. Sometimes markets are more reactive than what is necessary, and so it becomes a bit of a kind of a buy the rumor, sell the fact situation. But are there any real concerns that still exist in the market that you're saying maybe this could still be around for a bit longer?
Well, I think the unpredictability of Mr. Trump, who's got the levers on the biggest economy in the world. I mean, that we don't know. What happens in the next hour, we have absolutely no idea. I do think it's going to be very volatile for the few, the first couple of, I would say the first couple of weeks, and wait till the dust has settled a little bit. And then, of course, there is the concern that second biggest economy, China, who has been on holiday, are back tomorrow. We are there is apparently a phone call scheduled between Xi Jinping and Mr. Trump in the next 24 hours. So we're going to see what that happens, because China came out this afternoon with their version of some retaliatory tariffs. So, I mean, that could be a little bit of a sticking point. You can't have the two biggest economies in the world continuing to throw tariff grenades at each other. So that could be a bit of a problem. But as I say, I don't even put God on a limb. I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen tomorrow.
I don't think anyone does. As you rightly
No.
mentioned, Nick, is we're going to have to wait and see. And at any point in time now, we could wake up to news that we
Yeah.
didn't have the previous day. And I suppose that creates a bit of an awkward position for market participants, for investors, for anyone looking to try and not even necessarily try and make the most of the advantages, but try and avoid getting caught in the crossfire. We could realistically be in a trade war for the next 5 years. We don't know this yet.
We could. I mean, those who are sort of market watchers and perhaps, sitting in front of a trading screen on a daily basis, yes, there's going to be some opportunities. There's been some wild swings in a few of the asset classes. But, for long-term investors who are possibly, listening to the show, you've just got to be a little bit careful. I would certainly advocate a little bit of a sort of watch and see approach. Until we understand more in the next couple of weeks how the administration in America is playing out, how the sort of reciprocal parties are going to, talk about the tariffs, and then you might get some opportunities. Needless to say, the big concern, of course, is all these tariffs. I mean, we've spoken about it yet, but all these tariff ideas or salvos are going back and forth. They're generally quite inflationary. And that is not good. That's not good for markets, because you don't want to see high inflation, because it means the idea of the Federal Reserve, which is trying to be fiercely independent and duck the grenades that Mr. Trump is throwing at Jay Powell. They've got to probably certainly keep a lid on inflation, which means higher for rates for longer. So there's a lot of moving parts here that I'll certainly advocate those who are looking at getting in the market. I'll suggest just waiting till the dust settles a bit.
Waiting till the dust settles. When the dust will settle is anybody's guess. I think we're all at the mercy of the news and Truth Social and other platforms of that kind. It's going to be an interesting time in the markets, without a doubt. Thanks so much, Nick, for those contributions. Always lovely to catch up with you. Nick Kunz, Portfolio Manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, on the market movements as well as what could potentially be driving trader decisions.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise. And you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As we mentioned at the start of the show, we received the unfortunate news earlier today that the late business mogul Dow Steyn has passed away, sadly, at the age of 72. We're going to be taking a moment to reflect on his life and his legacy and his contributions towards the business community in South Africa. I'm joined on the line by Director for Archive and Dialogue at the Nelson Mandela Foundation, Vern Harris, to take a look at this. Good evening, Vern. Thanks so much for taking the time. Obviously not the best of circumstances to be having a conversation under, but nonetheless we reflect on the memories and the positive contributions that Mr. Steyn added towards the country and added towards the overall landscape of South Africa. How are you feeling at this moment?
Yeah, Jimmy, thank you. But by the way, I'm not director of Archive and Dialogue anymore, right? I'm a consultant to the foundation. Now I'm too old to be a full-time employee. How am I feeling? It's a sad day. It's a sad day.
It's very difficult to put into words, obviously. I understand that you had a personal relationship as well with Mr. Steyn. You knew him personally. You'd worked with him in the past. And I can imagine that that kind of relationship definitely provides a different perspective when the news hits. I mean, for a lot of people that read the news or receive the news, they might have an understanding of who that person was, but you have a very different understanding of who Dow Steyn was to you.
Well, you know, I wouldn't claim a friendship or a close relationship. I did know him, but I saw him, you know, in that space of Nelson Mandela, in the role that I was playing at the Nelson Mandela Foundation.
Mm. Vern, from your interactions with Dow Steyn and from your time kind of working with the Steyn side of it, the Mandela side of it, how did you see the contributions that came from or the relationships and what grew from that interaction?
Well, look, at one level, I think it's really important to say that, you know, Madiba had a friendship with Dow Steyn. That's what we're acknowledging in this moment. I think it's really important for the Nelson Mandela Foundation to do that. I think it's important, though, to step away from that and look at the broader context. You know, that friendship started in a period where the ANC was reaching out to big business in South Africa to support a transition to democracy. And in fact, you know, Dow met with the ANC before Madiba even came out of prison. And then as, you know, we moved into the democratic era, it became of fundamental importance to everything that that administration of Madiba's was seeking to do in terms of transformation, redistribution of wealth and so on, was to ensure that South African business, big business in South Africa, did the hard work to encourage global capital, big international investors, to invest in the country, invest in our democracy. That's the context within which that friendship between Madiba and Dow Steyn grew.
Vern, when you think back to Dow and all the interactions you would have had with the foundation or through the foundation rather, what are some of the fond memories that you will look back on and say those were iconic moments where things just looked different from that engagement?
Well, look, personally, I mean, the first time I met Dow was when he invited me to his house in, I think it was 2001, it could have been 2002. And I sat at his kitchen table and he had just got back from London. He had bought some really important Rivonia trial records on an auction. And he was asking me for advice. Are these authentic? You know, what is their value? What do they signify? Right. So that was an interesting way of connecting with him, because, You know, so much of the work that I then did at the foundation revolved around archive memory, reckoning with the past, and so on. I think in terms of his relationship with Madiba, the standout really is when Madiba was at his lowest in 1992, as he separated from Mamwini. He was looking for a home. He was looking for a next step. And he went and lived with Doe for several months in 1992. So Doe was there for him in that moment and was there for him again at later moments.
Vern, as someone who's done a lot of work in the archive space and in the preservation of memory space, what would you say would be something that we, as South Africans, as individuals, could take as the archive that is Doe Steyn, that we can remember him by as his contributions towards South Africa, contributions towards the industries that he touched, but also, like the Nelson Mandela Foundation, contributions towards the foundation?
Yeah, look, I'm not an expert in the realm of economy and finance and so on, but, you know, for me, Doe was larger than life, and his genius, from where I'm sitting, as you know, as an historian, as a memory professional, is his capacity to connect people, open up pathways, make social capital available to others, and we need that capacity more than ever in South Africa today.
Certainly something to hold on to in these trying times, and something to reflect on as we reflect on the life and the legacy that was such a big legacy. As you mentioned, Vern, it was a larger-than-life presence that was felt and left behind. We will leave the conversation there. We'll leave the memories there. And again, we send our thoughts and our condolences out to the Steyn family. That was Vern Harris of the Nelson Mandela Foundation joining us to reflect on the legacy and the life of Doe Steyn.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience. It's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendez, who's the chief executive officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we received more news from the Canal Plus stable around their intentions to outline a structure, so post-takeover structure of the MultiChoice deal. We know that deal has still been in the works, subject to regulatory approvals, and we finally got a bit of clarity around some of the concerns that might have been outlined by the regulators and by the legislation as we know it. We're going to be taking a look at what this all means for the MultiChoice deal. And its efforts to go ahead. I'm joined on the line by tech analyst and journalist at Business Day, Mudiwa Gavaza, to take a look at this. Good evening, Mudiwa. Lovely to catch up with you, as always. The last time you and I spoke about this deal, we had spoken about a lot of concerns that could present themselves given MultiChoice's position as a national broadcaster and the legislation around that. What clarity do we have now on the post-takeover structure that's being proposed here?
Good evening, Jimmy. Long time since we, you know, last spoke about this, and at least we have a good update that we can, you know, use as fodder for today. It's an interesting one that they've come up with, but it's probably the direction that many people would have expected because, you know, last year, one of the key insights that came through when Canal Plus first started buying up shares in MultiChoice, especially when they crossed the 35% mark, you know, and started debating around the issue of mandatory offer and all of that stuff. There were all of these issues around the 20% Electronic Communications Act restricts control of a broadcast licensee to 20%. And so a lot of people said, oh, no, it simply means that, you know, such a thing can't happen. But we saw from the takeover regulatory panel last year when they said the mandatory offer should be done, they were one of the first bodies or authorities to make a distinction between MultiChoice as a group versus MultiChoice South Africa as a holder of a broadcast license in South Africa. And it seems that the structure that is being proposed for the post-transaction, makes that particular distinction quite evident.
Modiwa, when we look at that structure, who will own what under the new structure? What does it look like? What happens to the BEE partners? What's being proposed here?
So what's happening is that MultiChoice South Africa is going to be separated into two distinct entities, because people will know that MultiChoice operates across Africa, and as such they host and hold a number of different broadcast licenses. But the one that's in question right now is the South Africa broadcast license. And in essence, what's going to happen is that they're going to carve out a separate company / entity that will hold that broadcast license. And then that particular company is going to then be majority owned by historically disadvantaged persons, and then MultiChoice will retain a 49% economic interest in that company, but will only vote up to 20% in that. And then that entity, that company, will then contract out, the billing platforms and all of the usual things, that comes with holding a license to MultiChoice and MultiChoice South Africa. And that's how this thing is being touted and done. Some notable, elements when it comes to how the deal is being structured is that when it comes to the different entities that are going to form part of it, we've got a 27% economic interest that will be held by Putumanati. Putumanati is probably one of the biggest and most successful BEE structures that we have in South Africa. They currently own 25% of MultiChoice South Africa, so they will own a 27% interest in this new entity that we're talking about. And then they're also going to bring in Sonia De Bruin's Identity Partners, as well as Ernest Quinda's Itai Capital. That's the Identity Partners Itai Consortium. And then there's also a consortium by AfriFund. That's former Telkom CEO Sipho Maseko's entity. And then there will also be an element of employee ownership through a workers' trust.
Now, Modiwa, there's a portion of the business that's effectively going to, or a carve out of the business that's effectively going to now stay with the Canal Plus, and that's a lot of the assets on the African continent and other things outside of the South African business. I want to play a bit of devil's advocate here. Could this be seen as an effective way of stripping out the parts of the business you don't really care about to get the parts of the business that you do want? I mean, I think back to something like the BHP Anglo deal, where they were interested in very specific assets. Is this something that could be seen potentially even by the regulator to say that this is a stripping out of the assets that's been given forward by law, but it works out in the benefit of Canal Plus?
A couple of ways to answer that question, but I think there's been a lot that's been said about a potential stripping, but I wouldn't say that this specific example would be an example of stripping. And the reason I'm saying that is because the way that MultiChoice is structured remember what we said earlier on, they operate in about 50 different countries. And in almost all of those countries, they've got a broadcast license. And they've structured themselves in almost all of those areas according to the different laws, you know, within those countries, right? So you can, in essence, think about all of the different broadcast licenses that they have as existing with a form of the type of deal that we're seeing right now. MultiChoice has to, you will likely have a lot of restrictions as to how MultiChoice operates its licenses in those different countries. So they've come up with all of those different structures, right? So South Africa just becomes the latest example of something like that. That's the first thing. The second thing is the fact that at the end of the day, MultiChoice still holds that 49% you know, interest in that news company to be carved out. Plus, they still hold on to 75% of MultiChoice South Africa. So the only thing that's changing in this particular structure is where and how the broadcast license in South Africa is being held, because that's where the headache around ownership was actually coming the way that headache was actually coming out from. So I wouldn't think about it, you know, as a stripping of the assets. And also at the end of the day, let's not forget that one of the biggest things that Canal Plus is likely wanting out of MultiChoice is distribution. When it comes to pay TV distribution, you'll be hard pressed to find a better form of distribution continent wide than what MultiChoice has been able, you know, to build over the last 40 years.
Mudiwa, does this deal kind of put MultiChoice in a better position? I know you and I have spoken about the positioning of the business and what they're doing in terms of product offering and all of that. Would this deal then allow the one side of things to go ahead from the takeover perspective, but then also put them in a better position to be able to return to being a profitable business? I mean, technically, if I remember correctly, there was a point where we were discussing things like technical insolvency.
This one is a tough one, and I'm going to answer you in two ways around this, Jimmy. The first one is that the way that the deal was initially premised, a couple of things have changed, you know, around that. One of which is the fact that when it was initially proposed, Canal Plus was looking at creating an entity that ends up having about 50 million subscribers across the African continent, and then they can take themselves to market and grow even more from there. However, since that deal was announced, we've seen, you know, to your point about technical insolvency, that MultiChoice has been losing a lot of subscribers, you know, over the last year. I believe over 20%, you know, of that subscriber base, right? So MultiChoice has a lot of clawing back that it needs to be done, right? That's one. Two, one of the big things around this is a question of whether or not MultiChoice needs Canal Plus to be profitable, right? In my view, I think MultiChoice can stand on its own and be profitable on its own. They've had the misfortune, I don't know if I can call it misfortune, but they've just had a dynamic where up until 2019, they were housed inside of Naspers. And if this deal is allowed to go through, they're just going to be housed inside of Canal Plus. So getting a sense of what a MultiChoice standalone on its own without a big brother or bigger entity is something that I don't think, from a profitability point of view, we've been able to get a sense of, you know, to say what is MultiChoice on its own for, let's say, a period of a decade, because it's just been 5 years now since they were unbundled out of Naspers, and they may soon be housed under yet another entity. So the investment case, or the question around can MultiChoice be profitable on its own, we may find ourselves in a situation where, at least in the short to medium term, we may never know what that actually means, a multi-choice standalone without a big brother or bigger entity housing it.
Mm. The other question that remains is, will the Competition Commission approve this proposed structure? Do you think this structure still presents a problem for the Competition Commission, or do you think this solves the concerns that have been highlighted with regards to the takeover?
Well, it does solve a lot of the concerns, because in addition to the Electronic Communications Act, you also have MultiChoice's Memorandum of Incorporation, which also had the same 20% stipulation, which was meant to be in line with that ECA. So if, on the one hand, the regulator is able to say, okay, fine, this is a deal, this is a structure that can, withstand scrutiny, then it would make sense, to say that, then it would make sense for your competition authorities, to allow the structure to go through. Now, whether or not this is good for competition, I would imagine that the SABC and perhaps eMedia might have a different take, on the whole thing, because they've long complained that, that MultiChoice holds what they see as a monopoly or, outsized market power in many industry, especially sports. We've seen, countless court cases around the sports rights that MultiChoice holds through SuperSport, with ETV and the SABC, complaining about that market structure, that market dominance. So that may be something to consider, but when it comes to remedies, I'm not too sure what the tribunal or the commission could say, to solve something like that, because that has been, if we're going to be honest, that's actually been the status quo for decades, right? So does the Competition Commission use this as an opportunity to perhaps correct the market in some way, or do they just simply let what's been happening just continue, in perpetuity?
Certainly some interesting thoughts and things we'd have to look at. Obviously, the deal is still ongoing. It still needs to be approved, but we'll keep an eye on it and see how it develops. Thanks so much, Mudiwa, for those insights and for the contributions. Mudiwa Gavaza, tech analyst and journalist at Business Day, joining me to take a look at the latest developments in the MultiChoice Canal Plus takeover deal.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And of course, on Thursday, we have the State of the Nation address to be delivered by the President of the Republic, President Cyril Ramaphosa. And ahead of that, we're going to be taking a look at what we could potentially expect, or what we should be thinking about ahead of that State of the Nation address. Obviously, as I mentioned at the start of our show, we will not be having our show on that day. There'll be a special build-up broadcast ahead of that State of the Nation address. So we will not get the opportunity to react to the State of the Nation until Monday. So we thought we'd have the conversation today, see if we can prepare for it ahead of time and see what our expectations are. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University School of Business and Governance to take a look at this. Dr. Parsons, good evening. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Your thoughts around the State of the Nation address. I want to get your expectations from a realistic point of view, but also your desired expectations around what you would like to hear. Let's perhaps start with your expectations for this year's SONA.
Yes, well, good evening to you. Look, I think quite rightly, the eyes of business and the markets will be sharply focused on the State of the Nation address. Indeed, should be, because its basic message in our current global and domestic economic circumstances have become of great importance. And we know that this is the first SONA through the 7th Democratic Parliament by President Ramaphosa as head of the GNU. It's the first opportunity to do so. So if we look at it from a business and a market point of view, from an internal point of view to start with, I think it's important that one of the expectations will be that Persona will outline how the GNU plans to now expedite far-reaching and urgent economic reforms, which will serve its commitment to higher job-rich growth, and in doing so, to build on the progress that we've made in the last few months. So the SONAR really needs to add some new dimensions to consolidate the work that we know is needed to create this bigger, stronger, and better economy that we need. But at the same time, we know that in the last few months, South Africa, as many other parts of the world, are facing new global risks and opportunities. So the SONAR will have to incorporate some adaptations and revised strategies to deal with the changing global environment. Now, there are several options, of course. Of course, we want to have dialogue and constructive engagement with our trading partners so that we can navigate the potential headwinds and perhaps convert them into tailwinds. What we really want to do as part of the SONAR is how do we make the South African economy more Trump-proof? That's quite important. So I think there are both internal and external challenges where the SONAR has to step up to the plate and show the new insights and the leadership that we would like to see.
Mm. Dr. Parsons, you touched on the GNU aspect of it, and I want to look at that in a bit more detail. As you mentioned, this is the first State of the Nation address under the new government of national unity, a government of coalitions, the government of whatever we're calling it in this day and age, but effectively a government of more than one political party. Is there some sense of concern or perhaps trepidation that comes with sitting there and having to balance the views of other parties from a presidential point of view? Or is it the time for the united parties to actually show that they are united?
Well, I think what's important, we know that with the formation of the GNU after our important election last year, the markets and business have responded very positively. Yes, they've accepted there will be hiccups. There are several stress tests which the GNU has had to pass and will continue to pass. But I think one message that needs to come out to the markets and to business is that we are beginning as a GNU to overcome some of those issues. Remember that the previous medium-term development plan was a legacy of the purely ANC government. Now, in the last few days, the GNU has been engaged on their medium-term development plan. So that will be an important part to see how much of that is incorporated in terms of what you expect the SONAR to do in terms of growth, employment, inequality, and so forth. So I think that's an important test that the SONAR has to pass, because from the point of view, as you saw, even when there was some media headlines that maybe the GNU was in danger, the markets didn't react well to that. They think that warts and all, we need to get out of the SONAR the next level, the next step of improvement in the GNU so that it can meet what it has said it's committed to, namely higher, inclusive, job-rich growth, which is what the markets and business also want to see.
Mm. Dr. Parsons, I want to take a look at something you alluded to, but something we've also been wondering and pondering about, and that is Trump-proofing the economy. I mean, we've seen some very clear statements out of Washington, a very clear and concise response out of the Union buildings and out of South Africa as well, addressing certain matters. Is the State of the Nation address another opportunity to then stand up and say, this is what is in the best interests of South Africa, this is what we're going to stand for, and to really put a firm foot down and say we will not be swayed either way? Is that an opportunity that the president should be using at a platform like that?
Obviously, clearly, because of the change in the global situation, and in particular in regard to the United States, I would hope that the president will address that. So far, I must say that I think the president has said all the right things. He has been calm. He's wanted to engage. He wants intensive and smarter diplomacy. After all, we are hosting the G20, which will mean, of course, President Trump will be coming to South Africa. We know that the Secretary of State of the U.S. will be here in 2 weeks' time. And we also know that next year it will be the U.S. that takes over the G20. So we have to be sensible. We have to embody in the GNO what some of the outlines are of how we're going to deal with it. We need to diversify our economy, of course. We need to maximize our interests in the African Free Trade Agreement, in BRICS. If I might use a nursery rhyme as a metaphor, you know the story of the three little pigs and the big bad wolf. The first one built his house of straw, and the big bad wolf blew it down. The second, of wood, it was also blown down. But the third little pig was smart, and he built his house of bricks, and the big bad wolf could huff and puff and couldn't blow it down. We have got to build an economy of bricks by engaging, and when I say bricks, I mean BRICKS, of course, but also BRICS. The fact is we need to strengthen our economy to follow through on the growth-friendly policies to which we are committed, because the best antidote to bad external news is a stronger economy and stronger growth. And so both the SONAR and subsequently the budget, which will come in 2 weeks' time, have to collectively say to the country and the world, we are going to control events in the interests of South Africa's economy and make both business markets and the population out there feel that there's confidence on which we can approach dealing with this year of 2025, which in any case is going to be a roller coaster year.
We have to put South Africa first. It's time to get it right and get that done. And the State of the Nation address coming up on Thursday is the best opportunity to put that foot forward. Thanks so much, Dr. Parsons, for those contributions. Dr. Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University School of Business and Governance on his thoughts and expectations ahead of the State of the Nation address on Thursday.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's once again time to take a look at Property Tuesdays. We do this every other Tuesday, alternating with our Agri Tuesdays. This week's Property Tuesday, we are taking a look at what you need to know about being married in community of property as it relates to home ownership. This is particularly following the fact that you can be considered to be in community of property after something as simple as lobola negotiations, because the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act of 1998 says that once lobola negotiations are concluded, that those negotiations represent a customary marriage. And such, if you're not very clear about what's going on, you could find yourself in an interesting pickle when it comes to property. We're going to be looking at property ownership and how you navigate that space once you've gone through the lobola negotiations. I'm joined on the line by the director at STBB Attorneys, Hopewell Satege, to take a look at this. Good evening, Hopewell. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by getting an understanding of the different kinds of structures where it relates to property. I mean, community of property, antenuptial agreements, all of those are legal structures from a marriage point of view. But when it comes to property, how do we understand the differences between these structures?
Sure. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you for having me. So in South Africa, unless you sign an contract, you are married in community of property. So what that means is that before you get married, you have to sign a contract to say that you want to be out of community of property. Now, in relation to property, that's state planning, I suppose. So if you are married in community of property, whatever assets that you have, whether you had it before or during marriage, is automatically part of the joint estate. So what that means is that whatever assets that you acquire together then forms part of the joint estate. So it's not just assets, it's also liabilities, whether it's loans and all those sort of things.
Hopewell, yeah. When someone is looking at the property side of it, why would I want to have this conversation ahead of purchasing a property? I mean, let's take a couple that's just concluded lobola negotiations or that has been married. Why do I want to have these conversations before looking at the property acquisition?
Yeah, so I suppose it speaks to estate, right? So whatever assets that you acquire, and we know going through the process of life, we acquire certain liabilities and assets. So it's important to have that conversation pre, so that you determine whether you want to share or you want to build this life with this person in relation to property. And difficult conversations that needs to be had, but you need to have it so that you can decide, you know. So for example, when if you decide to get married out of community of property, or in community of property rather, start signing an antenuptial contract, and you have a particular house registered in your name, whether the property is, if you get married and you don't sign an antenuptial contract, that property automatically forms part of the joint estate, regardless that it's owned or is registered only in the name of the one spouse. So it's important to have those conversations so that you can decide ultimately what you want to, what your assets, what needs to happen to them.
Mm. Hopal, yeah. What about the purchase itself? Is it wise to then perhaps say, let's finalize a purchase before we finalize the marriage side of it? How does that kind of shape up? Because obviously, if the home is purchased prior to that, again, looking at the different ways the estate can be structured, that means different things. Is it wise to pursue the property purchase prior to concluding the marriage side of things?
I think it's a personal decision. I say this because, you know, some people might say, look, I've had all these assets I've acquired and I want them to be part of my estate so that when I pass, you know, it's divided according to my wishes. And then in certain instances, some people say, look, we are building this life together. We are married. So therefore, whatever we acquire together, it's something that we've built and it's something that we'll share ultimately at death or divorce. So it's really a personal choice in terms of what do you want to do with your assets ultimately.
Hopal, what about the situations where you have part ownership? So I think about those that might have purchased a joint property. Say we've got a property Stockfell, we purchase a joint property in the joint names of a couple of individuals, and then I elect to go and get married after that. Yeah. Does my share of that form part of the estate? Is the entire property then subject to that?
Yeah.
How do we deal with kind of fractional ownership ahead of the new marriage structure?
Yeah, so and that's exactly, that's quite important in that, you know, whatever assets that you own, whether as a section, is part of the joint estate if you decide to get married in community of property, for example. So what that then, what that means is that if you're part of a Stockfell in your personal name, obviously, in your personal capacity, and you own, say, 25% of the whole of property, then that 25% at death or divorce will then be divided into two, so that a half of that 25% then is part of the estate, or it will be acquired by the spouse. So sharing is important. And then and I guess maybe let's take it to with business as well. If you're a director of a company and your company is acquiring a credit and they require the director or the directors to sign surety, you cannot do that if you married in community of property without the consent of the spouse. So what that means is that the spouse will then have to co-sign a consent to the spouse who's a director to enter into a surety agreement.
Hopal, on the property side of it, on the fractional side of it, what happens post-acquisition? So let's say we've got an antenuptial agreement that's in place with or without accrual, and that's a separate legal debate we can get into at another time. Let's say there's a contract in place and we're saying that the estates are going to be kept separate, and then we go and want to apply for a property as a joint party. Does that then mean that my portion would go into my individual estate in the event of a divorce or a split or something of the sort, and then your portion would go into your estate, even though on the bond application itself we're applying as a joint application?
So when you do a joint application, what that means is that if you both of you see a property that you like, you then sign an offer to purchase, and you still require the property together. So what that means is that, so maybe let me put it in this perspective. So if you acquire property, when you're married in community of property, the both of you guys have to then sign the offer to purchase because it's a joint estate. You know, you can't acquire assets in your sole capacity because it's a joint estate. So which then what that means is that when the property is registered, it will be part of the joint estate undivided. And then if it's out of community of property, you will acquire the property together and it will be 50-50. And then on that basis, then you need to apply for a bond in your joint capacity. So the 50-50, so the bond will be registered in both your names.
Mm. Hopewell, what about when you're in the situation already? So let's say you're already in community of property and now you want to consider perhaps introducing things like an anti-nuptial agreement. Can that be done post the marriage and after certain assets have been acquired? And does that then kind of put a line in the sand and say everything from here on forward is governed under this agreement, whereas everything prior is governed in a certain way? And is that a complicated change?
Yeah, and that's a very good question, and especially from the perspective of in community of property. So as I said earlier, that if you want to get married out of community of property, you have to do an antenuptial contract. So what an antenuptial contract is that when you get married, you decide that you're going to have this contract and your assets that are separate. So if you're married in community of property and you decide after marriage that you want to change, then you have to do a court process or court application where the court then gives you consent or to register a post-nuptial contract. So what then happens is that it's quite an expensive and involved process, in that you then have to advertise in the local newspaper where it says that because as creditors and third parties are involved, they need to be advised that of the process so that they can decide if they want to object. So after that, then the court will then grant you permission or an order to say that a post-nuptial contract can be registered.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave that conversation there. Lots to consider when you're thinking about the impact of being married in community property on home ownership. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.